Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry. I'm your host, Andrew Jelina, and today we are lucky to have Mike Bro with us, longtime friend, longtime programmer and software consultant, and the original founder of Syrinx. How are you doing today, Mike?
Great. How are you?
All right. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
One question I often ask up front is just everyone's origin story. So how did you become Spider-Man?
I'm one of the lucky ones where a lot of people grow up wondering what they want to do with their lives. I never had that problem. My dad was a software engineer. He graduated from college in 56. This was before computer science. And they had these mainframes and they're trying to think of who would be good at programming these things. And they decided math majors. And so he got a job after he graduated and stayed there for 27 years. He worked on a phone system for the Army. He did NSA stuff and things like that. And so I always wanted to be like my dad. I was really lucky in the sense that we had a dumb terminal in 1976. So this is like war games. It's before VT-100.
Like in your house?
Yeah. He would bring it home on weekends.
Oh.
Yeah. And so this is before. It's not a VT-100. It didn't even have a screen. It was a printer with a keyboard attached to it. And the paper that it used was like bathroom. It looked like paper towels from like an elementary school. It was very specific.
So not like dot matrix paper with the little punchy holes at the edge?
Nope.
Oh.
Nope. It was smooth. It literally looked like paper towels from that. So yeah, no holes on the sides. It was like war games where you had to stick the phone on the side of it. I would play some games on that, like Adventure, like the Colossal Cave.
Yep.
I was sending emails to people in 1976. I can still remember the sysadmin. Her name was Janice Bishop. So she and I would email. I'm not sure how we got away doing this because it was actually super classified projects.
Probably cost money of some sort too for the whole gig.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was that. So at 7, he decided that I should learn to start coding. I wrote my first for loop when I was 7.
You had me beat by a few years.
And then I usually joke that at that point, I'm essentially genetically engineered to do this. I loved it. And that's what I did every weekend was just spend time on the computer.
So you were a math major, not a CS guy in college.
Yep. That's also because of my dad. He was prescient in that sense. So he said a lot of things to me at a very young age. I think he saw a lot in me of like him. This was in the mid 80s. So maybe 84. He told me that I should be a math major, not a CS major, because if you do CS, it's more of a vocational kind of thing. Mm. And they teach you to learn a specific language where if you're a math major, it teaches you problem solving and you can learn any language. Fast forward to now, there were no cell phones then. There was no web. That's really helped me so much because again, if you can break down the problem and think the right way, that's really programming. So it's easy to learn a new language if you can break the problem down into workable parts.
Then you had a full-time job for a while, but then I think relatively early on, you decided to become a consultant.
Yep.
What was the kind of impetus?
98. So I did, my last full-time job before that was Y2K problems. They're a big deal in the late 90s. Mm. So I got a job at a financial services company where I was going to help migrate off of IBM OS2 Warp to NT4.0.
Sweet.
And we were going to rewrite everything in VB5, which had just come out. And I was really excited. I get my job there. And then they tell me a week into it that the project's been pushed back for a year. I am writing like VB4 code against an Oracle database. A laptop was dual booting OS2 Warp and NT4.0. This was before plug and play and all that. You can imagine the driver hell that I was in.
Oof.
From the moment I had gone there, my last employer was asking me if I would go back and do some contracting on the side. And my oldest sister, much like she followed the path like my dad as well. She was at this point, she's had her own consulting company. She did programming in the healthcare industry. When hospitals want to form an HMO, she evaluates all their claim systems and figures out how to do the conversions. And during the process, she makes them all communicate with each other. So she had been on me to, hey, you know, you should really do your own thing. And this seemed like the opportunity. So I quit there after 2 months. It never makes it on my resume. So that's how I got into the consulting world.
How did you find gigs after that? Like, what did you do?
Just word of mouth, do a good job. And that was just basically, it wasn't that hard to find new stuff.
And how did you find your way to Monster?
People that I worked with at the main consulting gig I worked at. So I had one that I could do my 40 and then I could do other side stuff too. And if I took breaks, I could always go back. And so some people that were employees there ended up at Monster. And so they suggested that I go there because at the time in 2001, it's a hip internet company. It's one of the top 20 websites in the whole world. I had really only worked at smaller places then, and I just wanted some exposure to that kind of stuff.
Now, you always kind of had a bent towards like database stuff. What kind of drew you there?
I guess the math part is I usually end up working on parts of systems that are computationally intensive. That, I guess, is where the data is. So you need to figure out, if you're going to do complex math on something, you need to have access to the data. And so getting the data efficiently and storing the data efficiently is probably where I ended up in the database world. So I usually end up doing stuff in the middle tier in the database.
I never even really saw a relational database until, gosh, even my first job out of college, EDS, like there was no relational DB in the stuff I was doing. So I was writing stuff to talk to switches. I think it was after that guy, a colleague of mine, Dave from EDS, is like, oh, you should take this David Rosenstein article and go through it and do all this stuff. And that's how I learned relational SQL and how to do joins and the difference between inner and outer and so forth. Where'd you learn all that?
Microsoft Access. When I graduated from school, so I ended up being a math major like my dad. I was a statistics concentration and an economics minor because at that point, everyone I talked to wanted me to be an actuary. It was the highest paid per lowest stress rated job in the world. I didn't get a job as an actuary out of school. I got a job in the data entry department in a market research company. So in 95, there was kind of a recession. So after all my hard work, I was opening envelopes. Market research then was mailing people envelopes and they'd mail them back to you. My first day, I opened an envelope that was a survey from a cable company and it had the contents of an ashtray in it. So that was a tough first day. Also, I had paper cuts all over my hands. Every time someone comes over to shake my hand, I'm actively bleeding. It was interesting. I quickly realized that I needed to do something to get out of this. This is Windows Desktop has just kind of shown up at this point. I think it was 3.1. The timesheet system that we were using for, so it's project-based there. And so they want to be able to see if they're profitable. So you need to enter like a project code and then your time. It was just spreadsheets. So like every person had a tab or every project had their own spreadsheet. People are emailing them back and forth. Like it was just a complete mess. We used Microsoft Access to do a little bit of the data cleaning. We would get raw data and then we'd clean it up in Access and export it and then put it into SPSS or this cross-tabulation report program called WinCross. I realized that I really enjoyed Access and wanted to learn this. And it also too, at the time, you could also learn VB. It was VBA, though I don't even know if they called it that at the time. I got a copy of Access at home and I decided that my Hello World project was going to make a timesheet. And so I did it just on my own dollar at home, had it working, brought it into work one day and showed it to somebody. And they're like, oh my God, you just did this on your own? And I was like, yeah. Like, all right, you're not in the data entry department. You're now our software engineer. We only have one. And this is our timesheet. I got moved to the executive floor. no more opening envelopes. And at that point, I really became systems integrator for the whole company. There were about 63 people. So I would talk to the C-level executives about how they could. He was like, I have this spreadsheet and I want to get into the accounting system, which was called Peachtree. So,
oh yeah, I remember Peachtree. Oh,
and so the stuff I was doing, oh my God, I look back, I feel like Malkovich, like the things I've done in the name of God and country. I'm sending keystrokes and just anything you can do. I'm literally opening two programs and then cutting and pasting things, like writing BV to cut and paste things between two applications on a desktop.
Not too hacky.
Hitting the save button. Yeah. So Access is a great way. It has a wizard where you can drag and drop things as far as what you want your query results to be. And then you can look under the hood to see what the SQL is. And so like a lot of code generators, it works great to a point, but then there's going to be something you want to do that the generator won't let you. So you need to look under the hood and figure it out. And so that's where I learned SQL.
So I noticed a couple of things in your story there. One, you had the hobbyist approach as well, where, hey, I'd be doing this even if I didn't do it as a living. You wanted to learn something. So you came up with a project you thought you'd be interested in. You did it yourself. And then I'd say the other thing you did is winning by implementation. There's a few times when we'd be going back and forth about architecture somewhere, like back in web tech or something. And someone would say, well, I think we should do it this way and blah, blah, blah. I remember the Fulfiller UI, like this user interface so that people could mark things shipped. We'd been going back and forth about how we were going to do this. I was convinced that I had the right way. So I just spent a weekend, implemented the whole damn thing and came in Monday and was like, all right, here it is.
Exactly.
I'm going to use this.
Right.
And if you want something different, you have to write it.
Exactly.
What have you liked about being a consultant and what have you found tough over the years?
Communication was that I think it's true about everything in life, but specifically when you're your own company, you're responsible for doing all the communication. It's pretty common in our industry. The things that make engineers good engineers are usually the polar opposite of things that make them good communicators. It was really trial by fire for me, but that's really the hard part. And it's still the hard part. I mean, I've gotten a lot better at it, but I think you know, that's something that I'm going to work on my entire life. The client facing is hugely important. It's everything. And so it was trial by fire and a lot of that. I was doing some things in the property tax industry. This is the late 90s. So we're going from a DOS machine. Literally somebody picked up a mouse once and tried to talk into it, like Star Trek IV, you know, Scotty saying computer. That's the level that we're talking about. So I'm in a room with 30 people trying to teach them how to use this new software, which they really don't want. So they're screaming at me, running out of the room. I'm 25. There were lots of nights where I'm sitting alone in my hotel room, like, my God, like, how am I going to do this? Not surprisingly, humans are amazing creatures and you eventually get better at things.
Yeah, I think being a consultant relatively early in my career forced me to have a customer focus and think about, it's different when you're developing software for a big company and like you're five or six levels away from, you know, senior management, and you sometimes feel like what you're doing like never gets seen or whatever. When I was on site with one of WebTech's big customers there, you know, you were constantly having to show what you were doing and advocate the right way about something, but sometimes even end up working with other resources from the client that may or may not be cooperative, may or may not like you, but you have to get them to kind of play ball and march in the same direction in order to get the project done. So you had to learn how to influence people and try to win hearts and minds, as well as just getting your software written.
Exactly. And I still talk about that now, that when we have architecture decisions, and I'm very much a just enough architecture person, at the end of the day, we're shipping a product, and that's what the client cares about. So they don't care if you, you know, what design pattern you use from the Gang of Four book. Like, that shouldn't be the end game. The client's what matters. And so I think that that's one of the big things from consulting that you need to keep in focus.
So speaking of Gang of Four, we should talk about interviews too.
Okay.
Because I've definitely seen, you know, with all of our consultants, a lot of times they end up interviewing before they go on site with a client. We've seen client interview questions over the years, and the ones I like the best, I would say, are joint coding exercises where Googling is allowed, because that's the most realistic work scenario. Some people will say, well, you got to do this coding exercise, but we're going to proctor it and you're not allowed to look up any reference material. That's not usually how you're working. One of the ones I don't think was applicable is some folks have asked like CS 301 questions, like, what is the ON efficiency of an insertion into a hash table? And I would say, yeah, okay, it's important to know that if you're designing a hash table, but most of the time you're going to import some class and just start using it. There's a certain subset of people that need to know how to solve that problem if you have massive amounts of data and you need to be efficient about it. But 90, let's call it 7% of business app writing is not that. What have you seen from an interview question perspective that you thought made sense or was not in line with what the actual job was?
Yeah, that's 100%. And this is really controversial these days in interviewing, that that was a Google thing, like a lot of things in the tech industry now that came out of Google. And yes, when Google started implementing that, it's exactly what you said. There's a very, very small percentage of people that need those kind of skills. The last I knew, and I'm sure it changes, a Google query executes on 1,000 different boxes in 0.2 seconds. You need to worry about annotation, and you're up against the laws of physics, the things that they're doing. And for business applications, it's just not true at all. So I really don't understand where this is going. And you filter out a lot of people that I think are extremely qualified for business applications. I think a lot of that too goes back to when you had to write everything from scratch. I had somebody ask me if I could write a quicksort a couple years ago. And I said, no. And he asked me if I knew what a quicksort was. And I said, yes. He's like, when's the last time you wrote one? I was like, when I took AP Computer Science when I was in the 11th grade. That was Pascal. You didn't get shared libraries. You had to write everything from scratch. So it made sense then. Now, I feel that it's kind of hubris if you think you're going to write a better search than somebody else that made an open source version that probably did their thesis at Stanford on it. Like, I take the opposite approach. If you tell me you're writing your own quicksort, I probably want to fire you. Like, that's, what are you doing? Like, why are you reinventing the wheel? It's very common now that people want those kind of things. In some ways, I do feel it's kind of an age discrimination thing because, you know, again, I haven't been in college for 25 years. So yes, I knew these concepts, but I don't know them now. It's an interesting thing. I love learning more than anything else, but I want to learn things that I feel are applicable. And yes, I could force myself to learn these. There's a famous book called Cracking the Coding Interview for a woman. She was an interviewer at Apple and Google, and yep. She wrote a book. I think there's 140 questions in it, and you can go through all of them and memorize them. And then you could pass these interviews. It takes a long time. The problems are pretty hard. It bothers me on some level that you're memorizing things that you will absolutely never use. I've worked on a lot of different systems now for a lot of different types of clients and applications and different places on the stack. And I just don't understand why I would bother learning this stuff if you're really never going to use it. It's
for some reason, what you were just describing made me think of like, you go to a gym and someone's like, show me how much you can curl. And so you do a bunch of them and you're like, look at these big biceps. So like, you're never going to use those in this job.
It's intellectual masturbation.
All right. We can keep our PG rating with that.
Okay.
What about people who have not invented here syndrome? Like, if you run into folks where you're working at a client and they feel like if they didn't write it, that they don't want to use it, that they need to rewrite everything, kind of like the interviewing thing you were talking about, but with code, like we need every widget to be in-house.
Yeah. Again, I feel that's hubris. And even that's one important thing that I think buys you a lot of credibility with clients, because of course, from my standpoint, we should always say that we'll build it ourselves, right? But that's not the right thing to do. And I'm a huge buy versus build person. And you should only do things, the only custom code that you should write, if you can help it, is something that's applicable to your business. If you work somewhere that tracks runs, then the only things that you should write in-house are something that has to do with runs. If it has something to do with anything else, billing, like anything else like that, you should try and buy it first. And that should be a last resort. There is definitely some of that, like, oh, we can do it better. It's a constant battle, but I think that that's an important one to fight if you want client satisfaction at the end of the day.
Underserved is fortunate to be sponsored by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. Syrinx provides bolt-on software development capacity to accelerate your software projects. Syrinx works with your team and your methodology, on-site or off-site, to deliver on time and on budget. They work in any technology stack: React, Angular, Java, .NET, Python, front-end, back-end, NoSQL, MySQL, any SQL you can come up with, they have experts. You need architects, developers, QA folks, project managers, analysts, data scientists, Syrinx can help everywhere in the software development lifecycle, anywhere in the United States. Syrinx also does complete outsourced software project development if you need a turnkey end-to-end solution, or if you just need an individual resource to fill a development gap. With 100% of their resources onshore and a 20-year track record of success, you can trust Syrinx to get it right the first time. You can reach them today at syrinx.com or 888-579-7469. That is 888-5-SYRINX. Expand your software development bandwidth at syrinx.com. So are there any other stories you could share with us about your dad and kind of him instilling the either work ethic or wanting to be a programmer?
Yeah, yeah. The best thing that happened to me in my young programming career is not only did my dad work at a defense contractor, where that's a whole different thing. So he worked on the phone system for the Army. It was a million line Pascal program. It is the phone that Norman Schwarzkopf spoke on Desert Storm. I know very little about it for obvious reasons. He took me to work once. It was actually in Needham, the building, not that far from here. There were Army guys that I needed to go through. I was nine. All the equipment was shielded with metal that you'd look like you'd buy at Home Depot. The Army would come periodically and put a truck out in the parking lot where every key gives off a slightly different frequency. Very, very different. They had a machine that if your computer wasn't shielded, they could see exactly what you were typing. That's the level.
Van Eck freaking, that is called.
Okay. All right.
I think you can read monitors that way.
Okay.
You can actually duplicate the contents of an old CRT monitor.
Ah, all right. I didn't know a whole lot about the kind of things that he did, but on top of that, he also taught programming and math classes at Bentley BU Northeastern. In 1984, BU asked him, I think he had been teaching Fortran there for years. They asked him to learn assembly language to teach a class for an IBM PC XT. So I had one in my house in 1984. It was 512K, so I couldn't even run all DOS programs and had a 20 meg hard drive. But that was what really opened up.
It had a hard drive?
Yep.
In 84?
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah. And that really opened up everything for me.
That's nasty.
Because anyone else that I was in school with, so 84, I'm 12, I'm in the sixth grade. Anyone else that had any interest in computers, there were a few at some schools. There were labs where maybe you could get on a TRS-80 if you were lucky. I didn't have to do that. Like, I literally had a computer in my house. Very quickly, that became a paperweight. BU never asked for it back. So that was my computer all through college. So I never had to spend in the lab anytime. Again, like hobbyists, like I was always on that thing. And so that really changed when I look back. Like, that gave me an advantage that nobody else had. And that really allowed me to learn things way before anybody else could.
But now I feel like if you buy kids a laptop early, they're going to use it to watch YouTube videos.
Yeah, it's totally different. But there is definitely, you could probably talk about this too, that there was a fear of computers. I mean, I know this from when, you know, the person was talking to the mouse and they're yelling at me and all that. that was a huge advantage that I had over everybody else in the job market because people are terrified of it. Yeah. Now my 11-year-old nephew, quite the opposite. They're not afraid of electronics. You can't separate them from it. There's now a whole generation of people that grew up not knowing life without the internet or not knowing life without a PC. So it's definitely changed the economy.
All right. So you've been a consultant in many jobs, but you've also been a full-time employee here and there from time to time. What did you like? Any noteworthy experiences being an employee anywhere or things that you liked over consulting?
There's more of a sense of camaraderie when you're in a company and you're part of something. I mean, my time at Monster, you know, where I met you, obviously, that was really my first exposure to a ton of incredibly smart people. Learning's more important to me than anything. That was an opportunity where there were so many people that I could learn stuff from that were incredibly smart. No holds barred, like, hey, we're going to solve this problem. At the time, you didn't have an option. Like, there was nowhere, there's no Stack Overflow. You just had to figure this stuff out. Monster had a tremendous amount of traffic. It's like, all right, you know, there's nobody to go to solve these problems. And I've always really liked that. That's one of the things I like most about consulting. You're there because you can do things that their employees can't do. They wouldn't have you there otherwise. So they give you the hardest problems. Usually, hopefully, the best ones are like, all right, I'll give you the ball and get the hell out of your way. You just have to knock it out of the park. And it's a great feeling when you can do that. I've talked about like feeling sometimes that, you know, I feel like Luke Skywalker after he blows up the Death Star. I don't care how big it was or how scary it was. Like, you just knock it out of the park. That's winning. That's really the best feeling. It's a lot of pressure and there are really high expectations. They expect you to be perfect. And when you can deliver on all those things, it's very satisfying. The Monster thing. Yeah. You don't get any of that from consulting. Like, you're not supposed to learn from other people necessarily. You're brought in as a hired gun that's better than everybody else. When you're a full-time employee, hopefully that's not true. And there are people there that are your coworkers that you have a more non-confrontational relationship at times and that you can learn from there. So I learned a ton at Monster. More recently, I took a job at Runkeeper. They're a fitness tracking app. I describe myself as intellectually curious, and those are the kind of people that I want to work with. And that team there was just incredible as far as just being non-judgmental, like best solution wins. I don't care who thought of it. Being very flexible as far as the stack was Java first, Python next, Node third. And at that point, it's just like do anything to get it done. I'm a huge fan of Perl. Andrew taught me Perl for listeners in 2001. I'm still a huge fan. I had to write a Perl script 3 years ago because I tried everything else and it didn't work. It was a case where I had to do some integrations for an SFTP server. You are at the mercy of whatever ciphers are implemented on that server at the time it was stood up. Any Java libraries I found didn't have them. I go to connect and it just fails. Python, same way. Node, you're not really writing that kind of thing in Node and JavaScript's not.
The Node one in particular, like there was a scripting task came up a few years ago and I was working with an engineer on it and he starts using Node to do it from the command line. And first off, I think it's shelling out all these processes in parallel and he's having to do all these waits and stuff. I'm like, this is not a great tool for what you're looking to do, at least the way you're wielding it.
Callback hell. Well, that's a whole nother podcast. Is everything going to be JavaScript? If you ask a lot of people these days, they'll say yes. I still don't believe in that because everything doesn't need to be asynchronous. Yeah, you get in callback hell. Sometimes you just want it to wait without having to make a delegate to pass to a callback and then have all that crap. So the Perl, I try all this stuff and I was like, you know what? You know who's going to have a module on cPAN that does this? All I needed to do is just get a zip file off the server and copy it into S3. That's all. And I was like, yep, found the module, wrote a 5-line Perl script because I was being verbose. I just remember that we do scrums and standups and retros and all that stuff. I had been talking about trying to solve this problem. You say Perl now and people look at you like you're
a pariah.
It's like speaking Latin. It's a dead language. Like unless you're going to go to the Vatican, nobody's going to talk to you about it. And you really should be writing Python as far as everybody's concerned. So I'm at the meeting and I had talked about it before that this was a challenge. I was like, yeah, I finally figured out the SFTP thing. It's all containerized, so I didn't have to install Perl on all the production boxes. It's just in a Docker container, so it can run next to anything else without bothering anything. Nobody's at the mercy of whatever active Perl wants to install. So it's not bothering anybody else. It'll run side by side. So that was all fine. Nobody even knew it was Perl. I just deployed it like everything else. So somebody says, oh, how'd you solve it? I was like, oh, I found a Perl module. And this guy looked at me almost anywhere else in the world. And this is 2017. Somebody would have been like, Perl? Oh my God. The people on the team had so much respect for each other, rather than just blurt out the obvious answers that a smart person would have already tried. This guy looked at me and was like, I can't wait to hear about how you ended up on Perl. That is just amazing. And that I have never seen anywhere else since, or maybe even before. They were a Java shop. Whenever I've talked about C#, nobody was like, oh God, C#. That's what I do now. And when you mention Java, it's like, oh God, Java. I'm like, you should be in it for the problem solving, but that's really a great experience. That was a very long-winded answer for like what type of full-time jobs did I like. That was really great there.
You touched on something there at the tail end that made me think of what I'll call platform and editor bigotry and people that really get wrapped up in things. And one thing I think consulting forces you to do is you're not allowed to be a fanboy. If the client says, we're going to use Python for this, you're going to use Python for it because they have to support it. Sometimes you'll get asked like, hey, how do you think we should do this? Help us pick architecture, help us pick platform, help us pick tool set. But a lot of the time, they've got 8 other guys there that are going to support it after you're moved on. So they're going to dictate it. You start trying to look at everything objectively. Like, there's things I like about Java a lot. There's things I like about .NET. There's things I like about JavaScript. There's things I like about Perl still. Sometimes something is just the right tool for the job. A lot of people have a tough time being objective. And, you know, maybe it goes back to when we were tribal and primitive. Like, I fly this flag and this is the language of choice. And if you're not on this train, then you're not in my tribe. Did you see that a lot, either in full-time or consulting gigs you were in?
Yeah, it's huge. And even now, more so, especially. So a lot of my career, I've worked on the Microsoft stack, and Microsoft was as closed as anyone. Now they're obviously late to the game with open sourcing everything because they were forced to. The project I work on now is Microsoft Azure. They're adopting all sorts. I mean, cloud architecture was made at Google and Amazon, and that's all not Microsoft products. And so everything, when you install Git now on Windows, it installs a bash shell. Everything that you do is based on everything that came out of Google. But yeah, there's still a lot of, oh, did Microsoft create this? Like, is this a Microsoft tool? My answer is no, but it's the industry standard for the best tool for the job. And like, well, it's not a Microsoft tool. We can't use it. I'm like, no, like best solution wins. And even Microsoft is supporting these tools now, where in a lot of cases, they'll try and roll their own. And then they realize what's the point of competing. And then they'll just deprecate it and use the open source equivalent. So there's still a lot of that. There's less than there used to be just from out of necessity. The days are gone where you just worked on one language all day on, you know, for everything. And that's really the challenge these days, is to get one thing done over the course of a day. You might actually use 5 different languages. That's just the way things work. So there's still a ton of that now. And I'm interested to see how that plays out. Kind of what I was going back to with the consulting and leveling yourself up and learning from other people. A lot of it's fear that people are comfortable just doing C# in the Microsoft stack, and they don't want to learn any of the new things. They just kind of want to coast until they retire. That's going to be a problem. You need to keep leveling yourself up. The world's changing, and if you're not, you could go extinct.
I've seen full stack developer and DevOps are two terms that have gotten a lot of press and usage in the industry over the last several years. I kind of chuckle at it because I think you remember back in like 2001, come over to my apartment and I'd have a server stood up that I got off eBay and had our football pool running off that.
You had a hardware firewall?
Yeah, I wanted to figure out like, well, what are all these ops guys doing at Monster? And if I had to do it, if they weren't there for some reason, like, how do you get that done? How do you build the server? How do you set up the database? How do you get everything in place? And then how do you write the code on top of it? And I like just knowing like what all the pieces were. But now that's a whole thing.
Yep. Well, that goes to intellectual curiosity and all those things that I think that make great engineers. Like, you need to really love it. And it needs to be your hobby. That if you have free time, this is what you're going to be doing anyway. And you should always want to learn that. But yeah, the DevOps thing's interesting because it really has gone from people that used to be sysadmins are now DevOps people. And they don't want to be called DevOps people anymore. They want to be called SREs because that's the Google book. But yeah, it's really interesting. I found that I can learn a lot from some people that are really interested in that because they know a lot more about system administration and I know programming. So for me to learn DevOps, it's actually a really good relationship. There was a guy that sat next to me at Runkeeper that taught me all about Docker containers and all sorts of other things, but he didn't have much programming experience. He was a traditional sysadmin. When he needed to write a regular expression, he had no idea what it was. You know, we helped each other up and together we really leveled each other up. So it's interesting for a lot of people. But yeah, you're really expected to do everything these days, I think, more so.
But I've seen like, you know, just even in like a DevOps role, a lot of them have said, you know, oh, we need someone that can program.
Yeah.
And, you know, it used to be back in the day, you were one or the other. Like, and if you were programming, like you didn't want to touch the ops stuff. Sometimes there was kind of a looking down your nose from one side to the other, like, I know my side and you don't know anything about this. And sometimes even contentious within certain companies. And now I'm seeing more QA roles that are saying, hey, we actually need someone that can code.
Well, that could be a whole nother podcast too. Yeah, I've worked with some really good QA people over the years. And it is amazing that in some cases, I wish they were on the development team where they can write Java and C Sharp or whatever you need to. Like just you would hope like a good engineer, again, like you said, the client, like you're going to do whatever you need to do and you can't have this fanboyism. And yeah, everybody needs to code these days and in a lot of different languages. And for a lot of people, they just don't want to do it or can't for whatever reason. But that's where the world's headed.
So let's talk a bit about online gaming, online gambling, or things that they won't quite call gambling, like one day fantasy.
That's really changed everything. This whole concept of where you used to draft your fantasy team once and then you just stuck with it, or maybe you make some trades. But the whole fact that you can do one or even multiple in the same day really dominates everything. And that's a really interesting part of technology. DraftKings is right here in Boston. It's mostly Vistaprint people. They're actually Microsoft Stack. I imagine they're like one of the bigger companies here.
I would think so.
So yeah, they're SQL Server. They ping me all the time to do that stuff. The FanDuel thing, there was a lot of talk. Maybe 5 years ago, every other ad in an NFL game was either FanDuel or DraftKings. They were in a gray area, much like the online poker way back when in 2003, where maybe it should be regulated. I mean, maybe this isn't really gambling. And there were a lot of people that were advisors to them. They had tons of money and they're like, no, we're going to win this. It's like old Microsoft versus Netscape kind of thing. Like we're going to the mats. They spent an insane amount of money to have commercials during football games, which of course, as everyone who advised them predicted, then got the SEC involved. Like, who are these people? Why do they have all this money? And then that brought on a whole bunch of problems for them.
If I recall correctly, they said that we're not a game of chance. We're a game of skill because it's kind of like contract bridge where like there's going to be a certain outcome no matter what. And you're just, you and the other people are just predicting like who's going to have the best performance in it. It's worded that it's like, it's skill because you can look at it and it's not just a coin flip on things. Anything where you're putting money up, a whole bunch of people are doing the same thing. There's essentially a randomization engine, i.e. players performing or not performing. And someone does best at the end of the day, like seems to fit gambling for me. But like in California, the reason they have all those card rooms where you can go and play poker is because poker was deemed a game of skill because there you can, regardless of the cards, like the way you play, you can influence outcome and so forth. So they allowed that as opposed to full-on casinos in California for several years, I believe still to this day.
Yeah, so part of the main problem with that is it got popular overnight. Well, one, so they just thought, hey, we're fantasy. Like fantasy football was never considered gambling. Like you had always gone to CBS or whatever, you know, give you $10 when you're in a pool.
But the pool, so the distinction I saw there is like back at Monster when Don ran the pool or whatever, we would all give Don the money directly.
Okay.
This is before Venmo. So like we were all handing him cash and he would administer it using CBS Sports Online, Yahoo, whatever. But Yahoo could say, hey, I didn't know there's any money changing hands. Like I was just helping you keep track of the stats and who was winning.
Yeah. So now that I think about the reasons, there were a couple of things that were going on. So you have a set amount of budget to pick a certain team and you go head to head. There's a bunch of different ways to do it. But the most popular one at the time when it first came out was you each have a budget and you can pick a certain amount of players and you're going head to head against somebody else. Those players all cost different amount of money. So you really need to optimize your lineup. Also paying attention to what you think other people would do. So those values fluctuate. It's just like any odds. Like they adjust the number based on who people are picking. People wrote scripts to monitor the number changes like a Perl script. And the website wasn't designed to stop that kind of stuff. So you could fully automate it. And when something changed, they would notice that 1,000 people would play it. Again, you have to, in any gambling, you have to make a ton of bets. And so somebody would play 1,000 games a day. And anytime they played a number, like suddenly everything would change. Like their lineup would change. So you have a certain amount of time.
So is it like horse racing where like if everyone starts piling on one thing, like that guy's price changed for other people buying him down the road?
No, it's not parimutuel. Well, yeah, down the road, but it's like NFL lines. So like a line will open at, let's say 7 points, you're favored. If they want 50-50, so they just take the VIG. Mm. And so as you're betting, when I bet, I am locked into that number. So if I have it at 7, then I get 7. It's not like parimutuel wagering, which I know you weren't very fond of, which is really frustrating because you take something, you think it's 10-1 odds. And then when it goes off, it's 2-1 odds. And then the guy wins and you're like, okay, not exactly what I was hoping for. So yeah, you really have to wait till the last minute.
7-5 or some bullshit like it's that.
Kind of like that. So I think you have like a window of opportunity and you can, you know, basically have a lineup, but you haven't submitted it yet. And then you can modify it. So I read a really great article about somebody that does that. He was a software engineer that just crawled the website and learned how to manipulate the lineups based on the price changes and was just destroying everybody. So when the SEC came along, they considered that kind of like an insider information or an advantage, similar to stock market, like gives people an unfair advantage.
Was that the guy that was working there? Wasn't there an employee of FanDuel? Or
that's the second thing I was talking about. Okay. So that's one thing, is that people were automating it and the SEC felt that that was giving them an unfair advantage. The second part was people that worked there were actually betting and they had access to all this data that other people didn't, which gave them a huge unfair advantage. And that literally is insider trading. So those two things were what caused their problems. So you don't hear much about them at all anymore. I know some people that work at DraftKings. They are doing legalized sports gambling now. Hugely so. That's what they devote a lot of their stuff to. You never see ads for Daily Fantasy anymore.
Is that segmented by state?
Yeah, so you can only do it in states where it's legal. So I think Jersey.
I'm sure Nevada is thrilled of that and is not lobbying it at all.
So legalized sports gambling, actually, the teams now want a percentage of this, which never made any sense to me. I was like, why do you deserve a percentage of the gambling revenue? Like, this product's always existed. Gambling's always existed. Mm. The term that they used, I don't like it, but whoever came up with it is a genius. The NFL is asking lawmakers to implement something called integrity fees.
Okay. And what's their meaning behind that?
That now that there's legalized gambling, that they need to be extra sure that the games are legitimate and they want a percentage of all the legalized gambling rate. And it's called integrity fees. So they want like 2% of everything that happens. Now, going back to the Black Sox and fixing is like, that's the biggest fear of anyone. If you run a professional sports team, is that the competition is not legitimate. The fact that now they're actually saying, oh no, now we actually are going to care more, is just completely insane. A brilliant lawyer came up with the integrity fees concept though, and it really looks like it's going to work. So God bless them.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because if I'm the sports book, I'm like, no, you're just trying to throw a tax on here.
Absolutely.
And I've already got to pay all this money to the government and
yeah.
Regulation and the gaming commission and this and that. You're just another hand out. When I went to England with my daughter for a soccer trip, we toured a few stadiums and we got to see a couple games in some of the bigger stadiums. And the one thing that struck me is how much gambling is just absolutely ingrained there. Like, you can see it from the sponsorships, like, you know, Sport Pesa or whoever is right across the chest of Everton or whatever team it is. And you go in the stadiums and there's like little stalls inside there to bet. You walk down the street in London, there's these little kiosk style stores to bet. You can bet anywhere on anything in soccer on what's going to happen. But I never heard of anything over there where the betting guys actually had to kick back to the teams other than sponsoring them if they wanted to.
It's a great question. I hadn't thought of that. And it might be true, but the article I read about the integrity fees made it sound like it was a brand new concept. I assume that the sports books in Europe, if the soccer team said that, would be like, go to hell. But it is
maybe the ones in the stadium, I would imagine they pay more than stall rent.
I don't know, but I just don't get like why you would ever pay that. What are they going to do? Stop playing the games if you don't do it?
Yeah.
No. Like, I just don't understand what leverage they have. Zero. The reason the injured list exists is for gambling. Literally. They would never say that, but that's really what it's for. That's always been kind of the dirty secret. It's always been that way in England. That I remember reading years ago, Tiger Woods was playing at the British Open and he said he bet on himself. And I was like, what? Like, that was because obviously the broadcasters still do not talk about gambling. They're not supposed to talk about lines ever. Like, you'll never hear a football broadcaster talk about a betting line because they want to pretend that it never existed. Hmm. But yeah, Tiger openly saying that he bet on himself, which is perfectly legal. Floyd Mayweather used to bet on himself for boxing matches too.
Now, what about betting against yourself? Like that guy in Pulp Fiction.
Pete Rose? No. Well, that is
he was betting for himself against a supposedly fixed line in that fictional example.
No. That is, you go to jail for that. And that's obviously, that's the worst thing that can happen in sports is from a like commissioner standpoint, is that the games are fixed. I mean, it happened to the Black Sox. There's a movie about it called Eight Men Out. Really good, actually. Michael Madsen's in it and he's not a psycho. There was a basketball controversy. This guy named Tim Donaghy, who clearly was betting on games. He was an official. And an official in basketball can really influence the game.
Oh, yeah. That last 2 minutes when there's like a zillion timeouts. Fouls.
Foul somebody out of the game.
Yeah.
Hugely so. There was a huge paper trail that he had made a million phone calls before days of certain games and all these things. He somehow was painted as a rogue and they cut him loose. Nobody believes that that's true. So this has always been a battle that the leagues needed to fight against for the most part now because the salaries are so high. It's not an issue. The gamblers just don't have enough money for the people to throw their careers away. Back in the day, I mean, not that long ago, if there's 53 men on the roster in football, you can dress 46 guys on a given day. The other seven guys are working the concession stand in the 50s. I mean, that's a true story. Like,
wow.
The guy that used to own the Bruins, Eddie Shore, he was the manager too. Like, yeah, if you didn't dress, like you were changing light bulbs. They're not doing that these days. But there has been a lot of, as far as fixing goes, Italian soccer league has a scandal constantly. Like it's seemingly every couple of years.
It's like High Line down south.
Where people are throwing games. Yeah. There was a tennis one relatively recently. Again, that's a single person sport. So that's real easy. There's some controversy with that. But I think the integrity fee thing is new. And I just think it's completely indefensible. But shockingly, I think it's going to work.